You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 16th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Julian Assange, granted asylum by Ecuador, yet trapped in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. We're hoping to have someone on from the Center for Constitutional Rights later in the program. Stay with us. We shall see. Also on the program today, we will run an interview. One of several that we will run over the next week that I did with David Rakoff over the years. Just passed away this week at age 47. Also on the program today, the DREAM Act, or a reasonable facsimile, the deferred action status allowing children of undocumented immigrants who came to this country by no choice of their own, goes into effect today, having dramatic impact on the lives of potentially 2 million children. Also on the program today, the real problem with Paul Ryan is that we're not supposed to have these arguments about taking people's Medicare away in public. Rand Paul turns out to be an idiot.
Surprise, surprise.
Also, well, we've got more stories on the program today. And so what we're going to do is we're going to start off with this interview that I did for Break Room Live, which was, as you know, a video show with David Rakoff back in October of 08. It's an interesting time because we are contemplating the victory of President Obama in the 2008 election, and our hopes for the Obama presidency, our concerns about Obama the candidate, and remember now, we're a month out from the financial crisis, essentially hitting its peak point. And so we were talking about the potential implications of this crisis. So an interesting interview. And, again, I mentioned earlier in the week, David Rakoff had passed. Just a very funny guy, and also a very, just an incredibly sweet man. And so I'm going to be running this one, and over the next week, as we dig through the archives, we'll be running one or two more, I believe. So here's that interview, and then hopefully when we get back, we will have someone from the Center for Constitutional Rights on the Assange case. If not, I will get you updated. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this quick break. And now that interview with David Rakoff from Break Room Live in October of 2008. And at one point I referenced that Marc Maron is on the Skype. He was on the road at that time. So here's the interview. Enjoy.
Rack on tour. I think we actually were going to put, we were going to chiron you rack on
rack
tour.
Rack on tour, that would be nice.
Yes, and This American Life, a quasi-journalist, right? Or a journalist?
What were you going to say? Go on, don't edit yourself.
You have at times said you're a bad journalist.
I used to be a bad reporter.
Oh, but
I'm a better reporter now.
Oh, all
but
right.
I'm still not super comfortable asking people questions that seem both prying and the answers seem obvious.
Right, that basically eliminates
reporting.
All reporting. Both.
But you know what I mean.
Yes,
terms of that.
The obvious thing is really annoying.
The obvious
when
thing
you know
is incredibly
the
annoying.
It really takes a lot of energy to ask a question.
And where you also feel like, what could they possibly say otherwise? You know,
right.
I don't cover a lot of fires.
You know what I mean?
But going up to somebody who's standing there in their underpants in front of their house that's going up in flames. And then having to say, how do you feel?
Right.
I can't do that.
That's why I don't interview a lot of politicians. Because I find that it's sort of like, it's going to be rote.
Please, spout on message for me.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And so,
I've only had that rarely, actually, when people are really so on message.
Wait, have you talked to a lot of politicians?
Yeah, but I mean, Barney Frank, for example, was not on message for me.
Barney Frank is an absolute cascade of words. Barney Frank's one of the guys that I'll interview.
Yeah.
Until we pissed him off, I think, at one point. Then
you pissed Barney Frank off?
I don't know if I did or somebody did or something. I don't know.
I mean, to the point that he won't come on?
I don't know. You know, people, bookers make up all sorts of stories, too, when they can't get somebody on the phone. But let me just say this, too. You're doing a reading at Seton Hall.
Seton Hall University, where I've never been before, but they very kindly invited me out.
And what are you going to read there? Is that a mystery?
Well,
what is this going to be?
It's on Thursday at 7 p.m.
Okay, so people can
in South Orange, New Jersey, which I don't know how to get to. I'm being taken, obviously. You know, I can't drive.
No, of course.
That's another sort of thing. If you're going to be a reporter, you should really not have to have your mom drive you to stories.
That would be awkward.
Yes, especially now she's getting on in years. She's 72 years old. It's kind of hard for her to get down from Canada to drive me to a story. So, I don't really like
being
a reporter.
Have you ever made your mother really do
it? No, never. Never.
Never? Not once?
No.
Does she drive?
Have you ever, sure, my mom
have you ever scheduled an interview when you knew your mother was going to be here so that she could drive you?
No. I've never. My work life and my family life don't really converge in that way. And also, I've never really reported a story in Canada.
Oh, all right.
Even though I'm from there originally. I've been here since 82.
Yeah, this is going to be embarrassing for David, but I said happy Canadian Thanksgiving.
And I didn't know what you were talking about.
And apparently it's today.
I used to cook Canadian Thanksgiving many, many years ago.
The irony is I don't even know what that is. Somebody just IM'd me and told me.
Well, and someone said, you know, to me years ago, about 20 years ago, what do you have to be thankful for? And I actually said, socialized medicine and gun control. Asshole. Oh, am I allowed to say that on this? I don't know what medium we're in right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I'm not sure that we're actually even in a medium.
This is like the movie Tron. This is the movie.
Yes. No, but you can say asshole. I'm convinced
really?
Of it.
I think it's basically a bank holiday in Canada. That's my feeling.
Theoretically, it should be a holiday here, but Mark, I don't know if you saw that, is in Vegas.
I didn't know where he was. He was so winced. That was not in the hotel. It was a very drafty hotel.
Oh, no. That was a pre-tape.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I've been Skyping with him in a hotel room.
Skyping. Listen to you.
Dude, look
like
at
the
this.
Kids. Yeah, Twittering. Hold on, I'm texting.
Yeah, do you Twitter?
No,
you don't
I
do
can't
anything
even text.
I, you don't even have a computer, do you?
I do have a computer. It's with me right here.
Right.
And I have a cell phone. Cell phone, like the gesture for cell phone. But I don't text or anything like that.
You will soon.
No.
Did you ever think you would have a cell phone?
No.
Right.
But it's too late for me.
No, buddy, what are you talking about?
I'm 44.
Oh, my God, you're almost as old as Marin.
No, I think I'm older than Marin.
I don't think so.
Hello?
I don't think so. He just heard himself. All right, so let's talk a little bit about this economic crisis, because you actually wrote a very prescient book in some respects.
Oh, about the culture of excess, yes.
Yes, don't get too comfortable.
Yes.
And
about how we all had too much stuff.
Seems like there's a course correction.
I think so, yes. There might be a change in the discourse, in the conversation that we have, which wouldn't be a bad thing. And it was a long time. Look, it's like turning around an ocean liner, because the thing that sort of spawned the book, Don't Get Too Comfortable, was actually something that happened during the Dinkins administration, which was a, well, you know, I've lived here since 82, so right. I remember when yuppies started to happen, when the yellow pin dot ties happened, when the Reaganite girls in their red Talbots shoulder padded jackets came. But they were so much a minority. They were absolutely a minority in the city. And then during the Dinkins administration, New York Magazine had some cover story, not Giuliani, Dinkins, about how pushy the homeless had become. And rather than sort of frog marching the entire editorial staff off to jail, nobody had a problem with it. It was like nobody actually examined why they might be pushy, what might be happening public right. policy-wise. And that was early days. You know, and then, of course, came the 90s with the Clintons and the boom and even more money. And then Giuliani, who just, you know, was just black days.
Right. Forget
the
stockbrokers who are saying greed is good. It's the homeless people who are so...
That they were so pushy. And then beyond...
They think they own the streets.
That's the thing. They went from being pushy to simply not existing in our right. eyes, not even being carbon-based human life forms. So it would be nice to see if that actually changed back in a way. The way it was in 1984, when, you know,
there was some semblance of balance.
There was some semblance. There was
New York is like New York is now like a huge gated community. I mean,
yes.
It's almost like New York in a way.
Yes.
I mean, it's so incredibly expansive.
It's unbelievable. But there are the telltale signs of infrastructure disintegration that are not fun and somewhat interesting. The subway. Have you been on the subway recently?
Yeah.
To go from either the extreme Upper West Side or to Brooklyn on the subway on the weekend is a four-hour journey, the way it used to be when I was younger and in college.
I would never go to either one of those places.
No, nor would I, my dear. Of course not.
No.
But you know what I mean.
Right.
It's sort of, so those sort of telltale fissures are starting to show in a way.
I think the big thing is going to be crime.
Well, that's the thing. I was mugged twice and robbed once during that time. I don't want that to happen again.
Right.
It may well.
But I think that's going to be the first thing, because I think
sure.
there's been an infrastructure upgrade over those years. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, when you had problems with the subways, it was a function of those trains being 60 years old.
Yeah.
Now those trains are only 10 years old, maybe some five even.
True, but the tunnels
are
150 years
old.
So,
I mean, but what do you think, how does this happen now? It's a big ship that turns around, but, I mean, is it just simply that people react, their value system changes when... having a lot of money, when they don't see as many other people having a lot of money, and when having a lot of money is simply not an option, it becomes more of an issue of just keeping your head above water?
I don't know, because we were... It was no more of an option for people who were voting aspirationally. They were never going to get that money, and they were still voting that way. I think that it's an actual shift in public attitude that, for better or for worse, and I actually think for better, it actually... makes a value judgment about greed.
Right.
And the actual discourse of people of faith, for example, that it goes back to being, you know, what was preached about poverty and helping the poor and that sort of stuff re-enters the discourse. That could be very interesting and very, very nice for us.
Now, are you suggesting that that it's changing on its own, or do you think that it's going to be a function of things like the stock market? I mean, I think, you know, when...
Here's the thing. If Obama wins, and I desperately hope that he does, but I'm trying not to make plans for election night, because I always made plans like booty call plans for the past two election nights, thinking, you know, I'm going to be in a crowd of like-minded Democrats. They're going to be cuter than me. They won't be losing their hair. And I'm going to get lucky. And it hasn't happened.
Because everybody's so depressed.
Because I just get drunk and I go home, you know, because I'm so sad
before they
declare Ohio.
The election at all.
But no, it is. No, it absolutely is. Because I would have stayed out. Right. I would have stayed out, but it's like I can't watch Ohio.
Okay.
So I go home and I, you know, take an Ativan and I go to sleep. I was going to say something so penetrating and interesting, and I can't even remember.
You were talking about...
Oh, if Obama wins. Right. Oh. His teachable moment, which could really be interesting, much in the way that Reagan got up on the global stage and said, government is the problem, not the solution, at his inauguration, Obama has to turn that around. And he actually has to say, because this is what people are actually finally realizing, which is, I need help. You know, it's the old libertarian argument. Right. It's like, I'm going to do it on my own. Really, how are you going to get out to the wilderness? On my road?
Right.
Reading your map by my streetlight? Not getting diarrhea on my water system? So it's that whole thing. So Obama needs to actually turn it around and actually say, guess what? We've been socialist at the top and capitalist at the bottom for too long. Government is actually what was placed here for us to help each other out. That's the social contract.
He sort of touched on that in the Democratic Convention speech. I mean, a little
yes.
bit. He's been sort of nibbling at the edges. But now it seems to me that the door to that is so wide open because we are about to nationalize some of the banks. We
exactly.
own an insurance. I mean, like, you just lost your microphone.
Oh, golly. So someone has to say, here, I'll keep talking. But they have to say that. They have to.
Buddy, is this the first time you've ever been involved in
it's a machine.
Involved?
It's a machine.
Wait.
Thanks, Mr. Cedar. Telegram
what?
For you.
Oh, it's just so
what is with the... But, you know, I feel like they've been dropping balls all over the place.
Yeah.
Someone should have said about Sarah Palin's convention speech, the thing where she said, is like, he'd rather read them their rights. It's like, yeah, because, you know, the freedoms that the freedom haters hate, your term,
right?
Those are them. Because you know where they don't read them their rights? Iraq.
That's, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of moments that have been so-called teachable moments.
Yeah,
it would have been nice to have seen
fumbled.
What Obama did in terms of race, to do it across the spectrum
sure.
of all these things, particularly the role of government and the idea of...
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he's a constitutional law professor. Theoretically, you would think...
Precisely.
He has some of that rhetoric.
Or even the little things. Like when McCain said suspended his campaign, she said, you in no way suspended your campaign. Take that out of the discourse. Take it off the table. You didn't suspend your campaign.
It's tough to judge Obama harshly on those elements
sure.
because he's been pretty successful in not going on...
In
the
rising above it,
very,
absolutely.
Very, very defensive. I mean, excuse me, very, very... what's the word I'm looking for? Disciplined, which
yes.
has been very impressive. I mean, I've,
sure.
I'm a skeptic of that stuff, and he has been. I give him credit for that.
Yeah, I'm just.
But he's
blowing
missed
it.
Some of these teaching moments.
Sure.
That are broader, making a larger case for liberalism.
And just the sheer misunderstanding of, you know, the Constitution and the rule of law and what it's gotten to us. But you're absolutely right in terms of that we are nationalizing things. I wish that they would somehow say, okay, you know, this is banking, this is abstract, but how about your health?
Well, I mean, AIG insures 90% of the country's airlines.
Yeah.
Anybody freaking out now?
Well,
because
this is,
you know, we own 80% of that company.
But this is the other thing. There's a... I had to write these little tales of terror for a radio show on National Public Radio. In fact, it's not about... I know. Another network. For
they
another
don't
network.
Use video cameras, do they?
No. They're... Oh, hey. Look at that. wow.
Yeah.
But they, you know, one of the tiny tales of terror that I wrote was, you know, after the gun-toting hockey mom ascended to the presidency, all of America turned away from resume-holding experts and put all the anesthesiologists and pilots in jail, and everybody was dead within a year.
Nice.
Because that's, you know, that's basically it.
This is the, I mean, this is taking that notion of, like, the
this
amateur
is,
generation online and taking it even the next
yeah,
step into,
this is your suspicion of resumes and qualifications? It's like, great, I'm just going to cut you open.
Well, this is, you know, the interesting thing is this was the whole Bush era was
yeah.
anti-intellectualism, and now it seems to have basically run its course.
I hope so, because I can't help but take it personally. Because here's the thing, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I understand that every one of my signifiers, because of the way I speak, you're lucky in your Kinsey placement, because you're a straight guy, you already have that kind of rough and tumble look. I speak like a schoolmarm. I, you know, I look like your basic Jewish homosexual nightmare. Do you know what I mean? I'm like a cartoon. About
I mean,
some...
you got a little bit of no.
No, alas not. So I can't help but take it personally. You know, because when they're talking about that kind of namby-pamby mincing expert, you know, who is in, by their lights, unpopulist and elitist and exclusionary, which in fact it's the very opposite,
right.
They're talking about me. I can't help but take it so... It's truly, it's like being called a faggot on the schoolyard again. It just fills me with this, like, deep race memory.
Well, I can't wait for them to start referring to people like that as Rakoffian.
That's very sweet of you. It'll never happen.
We are back. Is that where it ended? Okay. So forgive us. There was a couple of little technical difficulties there. We'll take that out, of course, for the podcast. People won't hear it. We haven't been able to reach anybody from the Center for Constitutional Rights regarding the Assange thing. So I will just get you updated now. Julian Assange has been in the Ecuadorian embassy since June 19th of this year. He was on bail in Great Britain and was slated to be extradited to Sweden for questioning regarding rape charges. Now, I'm in no position whatsoever to judge the validity of those rape charges. And I don't know, frankly, which is why we want to bring someone on who might have a better sense of these things, how common it is to extradite someone based on just for questioning regarding these rape charges. However, it is quite clear at this point that the Ecuadorian government feels that there was a substantial reason to believe that Julian Assange faced extradition from Sweden to America. In fact, they put out a list which provided the foundation of the asylum application that Julian Assange offered to the Ecuadorian government, that it was political offenses for which he was seeking asylum. The list includes the stipulation that Assange is an award-winning communications professional, that he shared with a global audience privileged documentary information generated by various sources, that there is strong evidence of retaliation by the country or countries that produced the information disclosed by Assange, that despite diplomatic efforts by Ecuador, countries which have required adequate safeguards to protect safety and life of Mr. Assange have refused to facilitate them, those safeguards. That is certain Ecuadorian authorities that it is possible that the extradition of Assange to a third country outside the European Union without proper guarantees for their safety and personal integrity. In other words, the implication there is that Assange can be extradited outside of the European Union to a third country, America, where there would be no proper guarantees for their safety and personal integrity. In other words, this is saying that we don't trust the United States to properly protect his rights. And based upon the treatment of Bradley Manning by the United States, there's, I think, justifiable reason to believe that the United States will go to incredibly enormous lengths in which to punish Assange. That legal evidence, and I should say that I'm getting this list from Kevin Gostola at Fire Dog Lake. That legal evidence clearly shows, given an extradition to the United States of America, Mr. Assange would not have a fair trial, could be tried by special courts or military, and is unlikely that is applied to cruel and degrading, and was sentenced to life imprisonment or capital punishment, which would not respect their human rights. In other words, this is Ecuador saying that there is clear evidence that it is possible, if not probable, that if Assange was extradited to the United States, he would be put through a supposed justice system that is, in fact, does not offer the opportunity for genuine justice. Bradley Manning's been sitting one time or another in a brig in solitary confinement for 2 years. For 2 years. Charges were filed almost a year, I believe it was, after he was imprisoned. that while Assange must answer for the investigation in Sweden, Ecuador is aware that the Swedish prosecutor has had a contradictory attitude that prevented Mr. Assange the full exercise of the legitimate right of defense. Ecuador is convinced that they have undermined the procedural rights of Mr. Assange during the investigation. Ecuador has found that Mr. Assange is without protection and assistance to be received from the state which he is a citizen. That following several public statements and diplomatic communications by officials from Britain, Sweden, and USA, it is inferred that these governments would not respect the conventions and treaties and give priority to domestic law school hierarchy in violation of rules express universal application, and that if Mr. Assange is reduced to custody in Sweden, as is customary in this country, it would start a chain of events that would prevent the further protective measures taken to avoid possible extradition to a third country. In other words, if he goes to Sweden, there would be no way to provide him protections after that point. And so Ecuador has offered Assange asylum. Meanwhile, while they were contemplating the offering of this asylum, the British, apparently, threatened Ecuador by saying that, I'll just read the quote from Ricardo Patino, the foreign minister of Ecuador, according to the New York Times, said that the British authorities had threatened to barge into the country's embassy in London if officials do not hand over Mr. Assange. Quote, today we have received from the United Kingdom an explicit threat in writing that they could assault our embassy in London if Ecuador does not hand over Julian Assange. He added, we're not a British colony. Just to give you a sense, you know, the question here is, does Assange have a legitimate concern that Sweden is pursuing him on the behest of the United States and that Sweden is prepared to send him to the United States where he would be subject to a process which would not provide him a fair trial on some form of espionage charges? Now, we're just talking about process here. If you were one of those people who have doubted Assange's claim that this was the process that he was facing, think about the idea that the British would storm the embassy to get a guy who is simply wanted for questioning for a rape charge in another country. Also note that Assange has said publicly that if he was that he is willing to go back to Sweden if he can get a promise that he would not be extradited to the United States. Also note that Ecuadorian officials met with Swedish officials and said, you can come to our embassy and question Assange all you want. If you have any doubt as to how completely inconsistent with the norms of diplomacy, how completely inconsistent the idea that the British would threaten to storm an embassy over this. Okay? If it was just about, I mean, literally just about the idea that this guy was going to be questioned. Kevin Gostola put on his blog, and I'm just going to pull this up here, put up on his blog at Fire Dog Lake, an exchange between himself and Mark White, who is from British Sky News, a reporter. And Kevin Gostola is tweeting to Ricardo Patino, who I believe is a EC attorney. I'm not sure. We've received reports indicating UK authorities could storm embassy if Assange not delivered. Mark White, this Sky reporter, writes back, that's a ridiculous statement to make. British law enforcement would never enter an embassy without permission. Godstola writes back, well, then Sky News will have no problem getting a UK official to swiftly deny this, quote, severe allegation. Mark White writes back, it's such an idiotic statement. No experienced journalist would even ask if that was a possibility. And then apparently, I don't know how much longer it took. Mark White writes, I stand corrected. Not such a ridiculous statement to make after all, it seems. And someone writes back, well, thank you. It's very big of you to reply. And he writes, no probs. I'm surprised by the tone of UK's letter. Clearly, they want to ratchet up the pressure.
He changed his mind after the photo of the letter that the Ecuadorian officials.
Indeed. So there's a couple of things to be learned from that exchange. One is just how anomalous this response by the British government is. And unprecedented it is in a situation like this. Just thoroughly unprecedented. Way beyond what one could rationally explain their behavior if this was about the questioning of a rape case. And then, of course, the response in and of itself is a wonderful metaphor for the way that Assange is treated and those who have supported his right to function, not unlike The Guardian, not unlike The New York Times, not unlike literally tens of publications around the world that publish this material that WikiLeaks was received. So this is a stunning, stunning situation. And it is unclear at this point if Assange will ever be able to leave the Ecuadorian embassy. He can travel in an Ecuadorian diplomatic car.
Well, the UK Foreign Office has put out a statement saying we will not allow Mr. Assange safe passage out of the UK.
And so there you have it. Now, remember, this is the same government that would not allow the extradition of Pinochet to take place. Now, granted, that was because of health issues, but it is just quite stunning. And it would seem to be irrational at this point. An irrational conclusion to make that this is simply about Sweden wanting to question Assange. Just completely irrational.
It also says in that statement that the UK does not recognize the principle of diplomatic asylum.
Wow. I wonder if they had not recognized that principle in the past.
I can't wait for them to need to get a British national out of one of their embassies in another country.
I mean, listen, the idea that you could set the precedent that one government would not recognize another government's notion of political asylum essentially and effectively opens the door that if we were to have in our embassy in China, let's say, a political dissident seeking political asylum. And the Chinese government would say, we have this guy and he is wanted for grand larceny. And he's claiming political asylum, but in fact, he's just a thief. So we're going to storm the U.S. embassy? I mean, can you just imagine? Can you imagine? This is stunning. And honestly, at this point, anyone who could rationally make the argument somehow that this is simply about Sweden wanting to question a rape suspect And this is not to minimize the crime of rape. It is not to minimize the charges against Assange. But as Mark Westbrot, a UK writer, I believe, from The Guardian, wrote, former Stockholm Chief District Prosecutor Sven Erik Alam also made it clear that the Swedish government had no legitimate reason to seek Assange's extradition when he testified that the decision of the Swedish government to extradite Assange is, quote, unreasonable and unprofessional, as well as unfair and disproportionate, because it could easily be questioned in the UK. But most importantly, the government of Ecuador agreed with Assange that he had a reasonable fear of a second extradition to the United States and persecution here in the United States for his activities as a journalist. The evidence for this was strong. Some examples, an ongoing investigation of Assange and WikiLeaks here in the United States, evidence that an indictment had already been prepared. It could, in fact, already exist and still be under seal, waiting for Assange to be in the hands of authorities that would readily extradite him to the United States. Evidence and statements by important public officials, such as Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, that he should be prosecuted for espionage, which carries a potential death penalty or life imprisonment. I mean, this is just beyond the pale, and it seems... that you would have to really be sticking your head in the sand at this point to not believe this hasn't been orchestrated by the United States government.
Your American embassy in China scenario happened all the way in May, actually, with the blind Chinese dissident who went to the American embassy and actually ended up coming to New York, I think maybe at the end of May, so they got him out in less than a month.
Indeed. So
imagine if China stormed the American embassy there.
Or threatened to. Or sent a letter in threatening to.
Just more historical perspective on this. Juan Cole flagged a story from in the 1950s, the United States allowed a dissident in Budapest, gave him diplomatic asylum for 15 years. Same scenario. Could you imagine if the Soviet Union had actually stormed that embassy during that time? What that would have done to the Cold War.
Now, just to give you a sense of how the establishment in this country, and I include the New York Times, who, by the way, and remember that in those initial releases, WikiLeaks never presented any of this information directly to the public. It presented it to different publications around the world who then presented it to the public. I never read any of those cable dispatches at WikiLeaks.org or in any place other than the New York Times, The Guardian, and a couple of other publications around the world. Here's the New York Times reporting on this story. It goes through the facts. Ecuadorian Foreign Minister Ricardo Patito at a news conference in Quito set a defiant tone over pressure from Britain. Patito said he hoped Britain would permit Assange to leave the embassy in London for Ecuador, a request Britain has rejected, saying it has a legal obligation to extradite Mr. Assange to Sweden, where he is wanted to face questioning about allegations of sexual misbehavior. The British Foreign Office said it was disappointed by the Ecuadorian announcement, but remained committed to a negotiated outcome to the standoff. Those close to Mr. Assange said one reason he does not want to be sent to Sweden is fears being charged with crimes in the United States for the release in 2010 of thousands of secret documents and diplomatic. I don't see anything here where it says the New York Times also released those. Right? I mean, I mean, think about this. Those close to Mr. Assange have said this. No one else, except for those who have a vested interest and a relationship with Mr. Assange, according to the Times. One reason why he doesn't want to be sent to Sweden is he fears being charged with crimes in the United States. That appears to be the only reason. He has specifically said publicly, I'll go if you can promise me not to be extradited there. You can question me here. I'd like to know what the other reasons that the New York Times seems to think exist that he is unwilling to go to Sweden. And this notion of the release of thousands of secret documents and diplomatic cables, who did they release them to? Not to the public, but to publications that released them to the public. Patino said the British authorities had threatened to barge in. It goes on to say Assange ended up at the embassy in June 19th of this year. And then the piece covering this takes a very strange twist. It mentions that the WikiLeaks founder sleeps on an air mattress in a small office, which has been converted into a bedroom, according to account of those who had visited him in the embassy. Fair enough. His presence is a challenge for employees of the embassy. Okay. And then it goes into Mr. Assange, who previously lived a nomadic existence, staying in the homes of friends, has developed a reputation as a unique houseguest. Suddenly, this turns into a style piece. Daniel Domscheit-Berg, who ran WikiLeaks with Mr. Assange until the two had a falling out in 2010, accused Mr. Assange in a memoir of staying for several months uninvited and of abusing his cat. Don't know how this is relevant to what is going down in London, but in an interview with the New York Times in early 2011, Mr. Domscheit-Berg added that Mr. Assange had refused to flush the toilet during his entire stay. Mr. Assange has countered that Domscheit-Berg and others who have given him personal accounts along these lines are motivated by malice. Seriously. Would the New York Times print a story if someone said, back when he was a non-candidate, Mitt Romney came to our house and didn't lift the toilet seat when he went to the bathroom? I mean, is there any relevance to the idea that Assange didn't flush the toilet somewhere at some time or even repeatedly? This is just stunning. It's just stunning. I just do not understand how they get away with this stuff. I really don't. I mean, there is no conspiracy theory after you read something like this that doesn't make sense. Is it the editor that's working for the U.S. government? Is it the writer? I mean, there's no conspiracy theory that seems to be too far out of bounds when you read something this just utterly ridiculous. Maureen Dowd wouldn't write this. Unbelievable. All right, we're going to take a break and head into the better half of the program. May talk a little bit more about Assange. We will also take your IMs and your phone calls at 646-257-3920. IMs at Majority FM or via Jabber. We've got just an amazing clip from CNBC. Probably the first time I've ever played a clip from CNBC, even including my appearances on CNBC. Which speaks to what I've been saying since the moment Paul Ryan was picked. But for the first 2 days, I was just telling this to my daughter, Mila, who is 7 and really just also just was not very quick on the uptake of this stuff. I had to just explain it to her over and over again. But that the pick of Paul Ryan can provide great leverage for those of us who are concerned that once reelected, President Obama will forge ahead with the grand bargain, and that perhaps this debate over Medicare could scuttle that grand bargain by making it too toxic for Obama and for the Democrats to take the position that it's okay to cut Medicare or Social Security in any way. This clip is really stunning and speaks to that point, that there's also a belief that that could happen, but by people who, of course, have no problem cutting Medicare. And, of course, we got another clip of Paul Ryan making an ass of himself. It's absolutely fantastic. I think I'll be on, Hardball this evening, mocking, I guess, Mitt Romney's treatment of his dog. But then over the weekend, I'll be on, I think, up with Chris. So we'll have a mixed bag of two. What did you want to say?
Maybe drawing some deeper lessons from the dog situation.
Yeah, well, I'll do my best.
Not just
mine. I'll do my best.
Yeah.
Folks, it's your support that makes the first half of this program possible. And it is your support which gets you some bonus time if you want it. But it's a bonus. You don't always have to get bonus time. It gets you a little star that you can put on your forehead. But it also keeps the first half of this program alive. And so any support you can give us would be appreciated. The best form of support is to become a member at majority.fm, but we have all sorts of other ways of supporting the show. JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get a Majority FM blend. You get 10% off. Buy your Amazon junk through our Amazon link. Give us a review on iTunes. DonateYourAccount.com. But becoming a member is the best thing you can do for us. Yes, if you're on our Sammy Cam, you can see I got a haircut. So that's my shout out to Jeff Smith. All right, folks, we'll see you in the better half of the program.